right, this is our first podcast for First Person Scholar. My name is Steve Wilcox. I'm in the editor-in-chief of the website.
This is Michael Hancock, editor of Book Reviews, and I'd like to take this moment to apologize for all of the names I will invariably mangle in the course of the next few minutes.
And I'm Jason Hauerlich. I'm essays editor for FPS.
So we've convened today to engage in a thought experiment where we assume that games can and should serve a positive heuristic role in our lives. We're going to explore whether that holds true and how that can come about. This begins really by discussing the problem or what the perceived problem of 21st century heroes and villains and what it means to be a hero and the current context, and how that agrees and disagrees with mainstream and independent gaming as well. So we're going to list a series of claims and then provide some examples and debate the validity of those claims. And the first one is, our media need to reflect the kind of heroics and villainy that we encounter in our lives, and games are well positioned to do that. So one example is at the recent PS4 announcement, we had a rep, or a game developer, come up and talk about Infamous. And the example, he set up that the series of real-world problems that were affecting essentially those of us in the 21st century in the West. And he positioned it as though that these were these serious challenges that we were going to face. And then he caps that off by saying, but what if you had superpowers? So there's this disconnect between a lot of what mainstream gaming wants to be in terms of its maturation process and what developers and publishers think is going to be fun. And what we wanted to talk about today is how that's fundamentally, that does a disservice to us as gamers, and it does a disservice to games as a medium.
Well, I think part of the problem is that we don't really have stable heroes and villains anymore like we might have once. When we think of villainy nowadays, and we, you know, tragically just saw this earlier this week in Boston, they're usually abstract concepts like terror or evil. And it's hard to pin down what those mean, and it's hard to put a sort of a face to those concepts. So games are still locked in this sort of binary opposition between a player and the opponents, whether it's AI or other players. And so I think it's really tough for games to get out of that binary model and to properly reflect the sort of postmodern fragmented view of what it means to be a villain or a hero.
Yeah, we've got a number of games that have various morality systems in them, but they're always very abstract, oversimplified things. Fable, Fallout, BioWare games. I think the Fable games are especially black and white in some of them. Do you kick the puppy? Do you pet the puppy? Sort of thing. And it's, in a way, I think players want clear stratification to know, okay, if I do this action, it will have this effect. And it has its roots back in the sort of Dungeons and Dragons type morality, but I think a part of it might also be the genre trippings that we're bringing into games, that fantasy has always, one of the appeals of fantasy has long been, even as far as back as Tolkien said, fantasy is for escapism, and that the demarcation into clear good and evil is part of it.
Yeah, I think that escapism is an important aspect, and I think it's something that we need to, if we're to continue to mature, we need to escape from. It's not necessarily escape from in the negative context, but it's a stigma that I think refrains or holds back games from taking that next step and to not. So we have that staple of video game theory that every simulation is an interpretation. And so you can't really have a fantasy setting that is entirely free of the trappings of the culture that produced that game. So escapism is a is kind of a mask for saying that don't read into this too much. And that's not really, that is that fair? Can we really say that the dynamic systems in, say, Skyrim or, Planescape Torment, that simulation is a benign interpretation? Does that not devalue the games that we engage with to the level that they are just fantasy? That seems quite dismissive, though, as well.
Absolutely, and let's take a moment to appreciate the phrase "escape from escapism." Yeah, obviously, saying that a game is pure escapism is the equivalent of saying they're just for fun. We're just playing. Saying that there's no ideology here is the number one sign that there's an ideology present.
I wonder though, just from a technical perspective, there's only so many if statements you can program. There's only so much you can do. So I wonder, do games nowadays even possess the technical capability to get rid of this good karma, bad karma, angel or demon sort of dichotomy that we see in games like Fable and even the BioWare games, which seem to give the illusion that there's a spectrum of good and evil. But at the end of the day, most of your options are either put into just that sort of binary, good or evil, and there's very little gray area.
I think you see that, though, with a game has its limited amount of resources for development, and I think that by prioritizing sometimes visuals, and weapon modeling, and kind of the visual trappings over and above the mechanics themselves, mm-hmm. is part of the problem, and I think that that's a succinct way of coming at critiquing something like BioShock Infinite. Mm-hmm. And so it's really interesting that there's a podcast that came out in 2011 in which it's a series of interviews with Looking Glass Studio members, former members of Looking Glass. And one of those is a sit-down with Ken Levine. And he's talking about how when they were working on the original Thief game, they wanted to get away from this idea that AI is either on or off. They wanted to create a third tertiary state where somebody is interested or intrigued or going to investigate the situation. And that immediately adds, it went from being one pole or the other, one extreme or the other, and it kind of, in a weird way, created sort of a gray area where you can engage with someone but not be in combative engagement with that person. And that's a very small step, but that's a very simple three-state instead of opposed to two-state system that is the basis for almost all modern stealth games. And it adds there's no coincidence that a lot of modern stealth games, Metal Gear Solid, Splinter Cell, you can use airfoils. There's some non-lethal combat options in stealth games, potentially because there's that third option of engaging someone in detecting you without having to outright kill that person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess, three is certainly better than two, but can we get beyond that even, I wonder? Or is it going to be ultimately, because of the limitations of the medium, going to be this sort of finite number of slots that you can, these options that you can have? So I just can't, reflect, if games want to do that, reflect the sort of complexity and the dynamism of our actual choices that we have in real life.
Well, if I can go into a fairly elaborate counterexample here, have either of you, I'm going to draw on what Steve mentioned about visual trappings in particular, that one of the ways that one of the uses people have found games to put a lot of options in has been text-based stuff, that you're still programming a finite number of variables, but you can account for a lot of different contingencies. Are either of you two familiar with The Baron, or De Baron?
I took a look at it, yeah.
Yeah, spoilers ahead. But that game is a very nice example of a game that's originally sets itself up as a good versus evil thing, where you play a woodcutter who is going to save his daughter from the evil Baron who's kidnapped her, and as you go through the game, you find out that it's actually dealing with a very real-life situation and a very serious real-life one. and it provides you with a number of different ways to respond to it. Everything from perpetuating the cycle, to committing suicide, to just running away, and then asks for your motivation behind it. It's still choosing from a linear number of options, but it's definitely broadening the scope. And it's easier for developers to broaden that kind of scope when they're dealing with text because, you know, it's just a less expensive in terms of the number of hours to develop. Well, I think that's fair.
And another, you know, it's almost like the Arthur C. Clarke expression where if it's complex enough, it becomes almost like magic. You don't feel compelled to pull back the lid of the box and see how it's operating. You're kind of content to say it's complex enough for me to believe in it. So another example of that would be the latest Deus Ex game, where there's actually an option where you can create a ghost of yourself in a way, and then it leaves the AI thinking that you're still there. And you can actually do that without using the ghost option. You can just peek your head above the box. They see you, crouch down, then sneak away, and they will assume that you're still in that position because that's tactically that makes sense. But in a lot of games, that would be considered dumb AI. The standard approach, especially in a game like Bioshock Infinite, is that they always know exactly where you are and they will pursue you relentlessly no matter where you are. There's no third state there. And so in a certain way, you can actually kind of dumb down AI to make them more believable in that respect. And we see that in, I think it's in Hamlet and the Holodeck? Or is it, what's the other? Brenda Laurel. What's that one? Computers is theater. She talks about how if something is fully animated to be looking realistic, then we expect it to behave in a more realistic manner. If it's a stick figure, we have a little more leeway with it. And so if you're going to tie visuals in, which, as Laurel points out, immediately raises your expectations of complexity, then I think that needs to be matched by social complexity. And you know, there's also the complexity of perception, whether, you know, characters can automatically know where you are. And that was my problem with Dishonored AI as well, is that they were dumb, but in all the wrong ways. You could be right in the edge of their peripheral vision for the entire game, and they would never really turn their head or gaze. It was very, there felt like there was this cone, and you were fine as long as you could just be on the edge of that cone. And it felt like almost cheating to play that game in a stealth manner because that level of sophistication wasn't really there.
Well, I think that also leads into an interesting point about multiplayer and why, you know, games like, you know, big budget shooters like Call of Duty, when you play the single player campaign, the AI is, you know, dumb as bricks. And same thing, they always know where you are and you can outsmart them very easily. But when you play the multiplayer, all of a sudden you add in this, you know, unpredictable human element and you have this level of dynamics that isn't there. So maybe even just incorporating more multiplayer elements might help add dynamism. And I think of a game like DayZ, which is pure, you know, obviously all multiplayer, and that game is you know, obviously terribly unpredictable, except, I mean, I guess you know that you're probably going to get killed a lot by people better than you, but apart from that, it's, you don't really know what to expect at any given time. It's more of this sort of sandbox or playground where stuff just sort of happens, rather than a sort of prescribed mode of gameplay. So I think, you know, the new Xbox, they're thinking of maybe going always online, and I think they're trying to incorporate that more. So it's going to be tough to balance what gamers want. They want predictability, they want, you know, their expectations fulfilled, but they also want something seemingly dynamic and unpredictable too.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. Like, I think we should come back to the zombie issue by way of going through the sort of second claim that we have set up here, and that, you know, unmitigated evil does little to help us grapple with contemporary problems. So obviously we have the zombie figure as this sort of unmitigated evil, but I'm more interested in the racist figure. So we recently had a guest speaker come into onto campus, Frankie Condon, and she just had a book come out on racism and The Help. And she pointed out that the mean characters, the people that are just flat out mean across the novel, are the most racist ones, and that just led me to think that oversimplifies the problem of racism to the point that if they're mean, if they're racist, they must also be mean. That's not necessarily true. There are nice people that are also deeply, deeply racist. And that's the problem that we need, that's the moral gray that we need to be grappling with. And that's the problem with a game like Bioshock Infinite that sets up that there's this racist figure, and immediately we should respond with ideas of aggression and violence. But the point really should be that we should be exploring what it takes for a nice person to actually buy into and invest into racist ideals. That's something that we need to grapple with in our current context of you know, villainy is moral ambiguity, not these extreme points that immediately sort of elicit this violent reaction. Why are these people willing to die for these causes? And we never see anything like that in a game like Bioshock Infinite. It's just blind faith in what we would deem from a 21st century perspective to be fundamentally flawed and completely abhorrent, you know?
Yeah, I think actually a movie that does that well, which sort of complicates the racist, is American History X, with Ed Norton. And so, if you're not familiar with the movie, basically looks at this white skinhead in the States. And he's a neo-Nazi. He eventually almost kills a black man and goes to jail. And throughout the movie, there's these flashbacks which sort of show why he's a racist. And you find out that his father was a police officer. His father was killed, presumably by a black man. And by the end of the movie, Ed Norton's character sort of comes around and he sort of sees the light. But I think it actually sort of humanized it, and sometimes you can see where the character thinks he makes sense, and you can see his logic, and you can at least see his reasoning, and you can disagree with it, but at least he's not this caricature of evil like we might see in something like Bioshock, and we sort of at least understand his motivations. And I think that's far more valuable to dealing with things like racism and bigotry than just having these characters of evil that you have to shoot in the face to deal with.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. It's about humanizing the villain rather than dehumanizing the villain. Dehumanization is exactly it's the root of the evil that we want to deal with. That's the basis for a lot of acts of terrorism and Nazism, is to create that distance between you and fundamentally another human being, such that you can then treat them as unmitigated evil, as something that must die regardless of its claim to life and its rights to life.
I thought if we can go over a few games that had some interesting counterexamples to this. The game Nier had an interesting take on this, that it was a game where you play through multiple times, and the game itself doesn't change, but the cutscenes do. And eventually, after a few playthroughs, you get the cutscenes all from the various creatures you fought perspective, and they were doing things like just protecting their home or mobilizing for an adventure, and you were basically this interloper who came in and slaughtered them. And it's not much, since it doesn't change the course of the game, what you're mechanically doing, but it offers a different perspective. Anyone else have a game that...
Yeah, it's not the best example, but Skyrim's, you know, uses the same binaries in a lot of ways, but I thought that the use of the political factions actually worked well. So, if you're not familiar, it's basically the Empire on one side, and the other faction is like a resistance sort of rebel group. And you can side with one or the other, but no matter what you do, you'll encounter opposite sides, and you'll sort of realize that they're just trying to sort of survive like anybody else. They have their own sort of political agenda. And again, they're not fully humanized, but they certainly are more so than just sort of zombies, terrorists, Nazis that we're used to seeing in video game bad guys. And so at times, you know, you're going through playing Skyrim and you might feel bad about killing, you know, someone that you've talked to who's on the opposite side, but you're sort of forced to through the game.
Yeah, I was just playing that last night, and because I'm still trying to beat Skyrim. And I was talking to the leader of the sort of the nativist position, the Stormcloaks, and his right hand man is just deeply racist.
Yeah.
He's constantly playing up on those tropes to maybe to motivate himself, maybe to motivate people around him. But if you push the leader of the Stormcloaks, it's much more political. It's much more about we have been used as fodder by the Empire, and we're not going to continue to sacrifice ourselves for someone that's not willing to sacrifice for us. And that's so simple. That's just two perspectives on the issue that create a context that says, okay, I can understand why someone would die for this. And then I was out on a mission with one of the guys, and we just attacked one of the cities, and then this is a follow-up mission. And the first thing he says to you is, that was my first mission in my life. Does it get any easier to kill people? And that's so simple. That's one line of dialogue that says, I have a interior moral code that I'm trying to rationalize with my actions, and that game. It's interesting because Bioshock Infinite's getting criticized because you can be the biggest mass murderer in Columbia's history because the number of people you kill is absolutely astounding, and you can actually do the same thing in Skyrim. But I feel a lot more culpable for my actions in Skyrim because I have an option to not pursue that line of engagement, and that's kind of what the beginning of this whole talk was about, was adding in the complexity that we need to have in order to develop some skills in terms of if games can impart skills on us. What are we teaching ourselves by having unmitigated evil? What are we teaching ourselves by having the lone soldier as hero? And so another example on the other side of the we have the racist villain trope. We also have the lone soldier. And that figure is also out of sync with what the current context is kind of asking for us in terms of our political and social engagement. And you know, you look at a game like I think you can see the disconnect between the idea that a lone soldier can be the solution to all of our problems in a game like Mass Effect 3, in which the entire universe is on hold while Commander Shepard just trucks around the universe doing whatever the hell he wants. Like, you can do side quest after side quest. What's that?
Also she.
She, yes. Okay, sorry. She. Yeah, that's a good point. Whatever he or she wants to do in the universe. And the home front, Earth, is essentially put on hold until you arrive. And for me, that really stretched my belief in this world. And it really, especially in a game where you can have a large team of very, ostensibly the most talented people in all of the universe, and you can only bring two of them with you. And it really stretches the believability of a world that is so invested in individualism when really it calls for collective action and sacrifice.
Well, it's interesting with Mass Effect 3 that there's basically, if you want full access to all the options of the ending, and we probably shouldn't get too distracted in the ending discussion, but if you want to access all of the choices there, you have to either have played through the entire series to accumulate the choices you need to get enough points, or you have to play in the multiplayer and cooperate with other people in order to build up that. And I've never actually done the multiplayer, so I can't comment on that, but it's gesturing towards maybe something more inclusive. But this is a step back a little, but I had if I could indulge in a brief Skyrim tangent. I think it was something that's come up interesting in terms of what we've talked about so far is that a lot of what we talked about isn't even necessarily a gameplay change as a framing change of some dialogue that gameplay-wise, the option not to kill, but also just some dialogue that acknowledges what's being done there. And Skyrim's interesting in that you kill hundreds of creatures constantly, if you're getting your skills up, probably. But there's still, and this is, there's still these moments where it's very careful to frame certain killings as important. I'm taking this idea largely from Robert Yang's Radiator Design blog, where he did a post on Oblivion, where he talked about how it framed the assassin missions so that suddenly it matters that you're killing things again. Suddenly these choices of when to kill matter again. And it's a segue for talking about the Skyrim version of the murder quests, where the whole thing starts with you in a shack being told by an assassin, okay, there's three people here, you can talk to each of them, you have to kill one of them, doesn't matter why, you just have to kill something to get out of this room. And suddenly the fact that you're killing things matters again.
Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about Skyrim too, in terms of adding complexity, is that you can level up by focusing exclusively on skills that are non-combat. Alchemy, smithing, but there are a lot more options than just, a game that tries to shoehorn in RPG elements into a shooter in
it
terms of...
It would not be a particularly interesting game to go off on those levels.
Yeah,
those
So look at, again, I know this is becoming kind of the our go-to, but the BioShock series, the only way that you can really improve your character is to build a better killing machine.
Well, that's not quite true. The first one, you also improve by taking pictures of things before you kill them.
You improved your ability to kill those things by taking pictures of those
things.
Yes. And that's...
Which is an interesting observation equals violence, kind of.
And to be clear, it's not that I'm not claiming that that all games should conform to this ideal of forwarding this, you know, socialist idea of educating ourselves through video games and developing skills that translate to the real world. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that there's kind of a disconnect between what games are offering and what we need from them. And by having this conversation, maybe we can start bridging that gap and having a conversation about what kind of games actually do bridge that gap for us, because they're out there. And this isn't a shining example, but a game like Stalker, the original design for it was that other stalkers in the game could actually beat the game before you. And that's one of the really interesting emergent AI games, where you can sit back and watch two forces just duke it out. And the resources are so scarce that you're almost better off doing that, because bullets are so hard to come by and bandages are so hard to come by. But I just love that whole idea of, if you don't pursue your objective, the world is dynamic enough to solve that problem for you, or to address that problem. And Deus Ex Human Revolution did that as well. With if you don't go to that hostage mission right away, there are consequences for your inactivity.
Even Dead Rising, I don't like how you're recording. It's frustrating because that clock just keeps ticking. And you can't just sort of mosey about like Shepard. And it matters. Have you guys seen the pacifist playthroughs of Skyrim on YouTube?
Mm-hmm.
Basically, players, they try to go through the whole game without actually killing anybody. There's other little playthroughs, like there's a vegetarian playthrough, and there's lots of these. But the pacifist playthrough is interesting because you still have to inflict death on the virtual enemies. But the pacifist playthroughs, you don't use swords or arrows or destruction spells like fire. What they eventually do is take on the role of like a mob boss. So they have to order hits. So what they'll do is they'll summon creatures to do the killing for them, or they'll cast a spell which turns the enemies on each other. But at the end of the day, they give you some leeway, but you're still having to inflict death if you're not the guy that sort of pulls the trigger. So again, there's no way to sort of talk it out with these enemies. There's no way to discuss your problems, and maybe you can work it all out. It's just they're trying to kill you, and so one way or another, you have to kill them. But still, I think that a game like Skyrim, which gives you that option, which allows you to sort of know the NPCs, certainly goes a long way when compared to games like Call of Duty or, you know, other shooters, where it's just clearly shoot everyone in the face, and that's how you get
and,
through.
And the mere fact that every character in Skyrim has a name,
yes, that's very important.
Has a name is deeply important. There is an identity there, though, right?
Where's Bandit? Means,
yeah.
That's a good point. Character. Yeah, you could read a lot
of
that.
Which is another
that.
Thing.
That's a good point.
I can't remember who did this article, but it could have been Yang again. It mentioned that they felt tricked at one point in Oblivion, because if you're wandering around in a dungeon, you can accidentally... Yes, it was Yang. It was exactly the Assassin's Creed. He talks about how the reason he started the Assassin's Creed quest in that one is that you have to kill an innocent NPC, and his innocent NPC was an orc that happen to randomly show up in a dungeon and have a name that, you know, you're not expecting an NPC to wander, that looks like an orc, especially, racism issue, to wander up to you, and he killed him that way and felt kind of cheated by the game.
Well, it's interesting, at the end of the Skyrim Assassin's Guild quest, is that it creates this Brotherhood Forever quest, in which it will procedurally generate people asking you to kill someone and targets for you to kill.
And create people just for the purpose of being killed.
Yes, and they will hang out in public places to make it entertaining for you to do that. But that's an interesting sort of system of procedurally generating quests.
I want to talk about Jason's pacifism playthrough for a second. It reminds me a lot of, this is a few years old now, but there was a website devoted to pacifist playthroughs of World of Warcraft. Mm-hmm. And that got very interesting because the players who decided to go this pacifist route would only use buffering type spells or healing type spells. And it got very antagonistic with them playing the game because everyone else thought that, okay, I took you on this raid and you're not doing your share anymore. That the game is so oriented towards the killing that if you're not doing the killing, you are being detrimental to the other people playing.
Right, I think within that world that you have to, again, you have to sort of kill, and it's, if you don't, like you say, you're sort of, you know, dragging the team down. So who's going to want to play with you? If who's going to want to take a pacifist to war, I suppose, right?
I remember one of the many failed Star Wars MMOs at one point, it was deemed a failure because it was more productive experience point-wise to be a bard or something like that than an actual fighter.
Yeah, and I think some games, I'm trying to think of shooters with where you can be just a medic in multiplayer, and so you don't even have to...
Team Fortress?
Yeah. So you don't even have to necessarily do killing, you can just you can just sort of heal your partners.
Well, WoW has that too.
Yeah, yeah.
Cleric character, would heal up. But you're
also expected to.
You're there as an extension of a larger body of a killing machine, essentially. Mm-hmm. And that's really what we want to talk about is, I guess it's not necessarily the complexity of the villains and the heroes so much as it is the complexity of the situation. Mm-hmm. So if the simulation is an interpretation, we're taking a very reductive interpretation of our current context, such that, and this is something I thought of when I was playing BioShock, and do we set games in the past because we think people were more gullible back then, the air quotes?
I think that's part of it. I mean, if the sort of binary medium has to have just reductive, simplistic representations, then I guess it's more believable that people are going to buy into that,
and
if it's back then.
Just, or setting it anywhere else. Yeah. Again, it's a fantasy.
Yeah, so like if you look at a movie like District 9, mm-hmm. how do you have a contemporary discussion of racism? You have to essentially make the other an alien. And now it's something that we're willing to accept and engage with. But could you set a game like Skyrim in contemporary times and not feel that a Western audience wouldn't accept this level of racism? But 100 years ago, people... Like, the game sets up that everyone, besides the resistance, which is... It's completely dichotomous. There's a very clear divide. And the people that are the waves and waves and waves of soldiers that you're fighting are completely buying into this racist Puritan ideal, and I feel that got past the censor of the mind because it was said 100 years ago, and of course people would believe in these ideals. Of course people would die for these ideals.
It's interesting that you see the games that do have the go out and kill everyone things that are set in contemporary times are much more likely to get the sort of people questioning the killing. I mean, that's been one of the major talking points for BioShock Infinite. I've heard people call the protagonist of L.A. Noire a psychopath for much the same reason. There's been a lot of talk recently about how... what's his name from Drake's Fortune is merrily going about slaying his way through people with quips. And I think we're more likely to notice a disconnect the closer it's set to our own.
Yeah, I mean, even I suppose...
Although, yeah, I don't know first-person shooters very well, how they handle this.
No, pretty much the same way. But I think, what they do is, it's not us, it's over there. So it's in the contemporary time, but it's over in Afghanistan or what have you. Or some fictional Middle Eastern country, which is backwards for whatever reason. They're culturally, religiously backwards. So they can buy into these dictators who are very, you know, simplistic and just spouting out slogans. We're different, though. We're not going to buy into that. So I think it does have to be out of your contemporary context. Now, what's interesting is there's all these games developed in the Middle East. The term Ed Halter called Islamo-gaming. And they sort of flipped the hero and villain dichotomy on its head a little bit. And so instead of being an American killing terrorists in Afghanistan, you're a young Palestinian boy resisting the Zionist occupation in an intifada. So you might be in Palestine or in Lebanon. And they still have, I mean, procedurally and ludologically, it's the same format. You have bad guys who want to kill you, so you have to kill them. But the narrative changes. The narrative's completely flipped. So even though the ludic structure is the same, the narrative is turned on its head.
Yeah, and I think that's a great, that taps into a lot of war rhetoric, right? Mm-hmm. Like how, it's a great commentary that you could take a game like America's Army and just reskin it and have it still apply as a training mechanism for people on the other side of the issue. That tells you that it's a broken system in my mind.
Yeah,
if the people that can wholesale adopt your mechanisms to the same end, it shows that that's a broken simulation, if you will. Mm-hmm. And I think that.
Well, what Mackin and Suleiman have written about, and they look at Islamo-gaming, is that the actual core mechanics of the first-person shooter is representative of American ideology, in which you're competitive, you're trying to be dominant over others, technical superiority wins the day in weaponry.
Individualism.
Whereas in these other games, so for example, Under Ash or Under Siege, in which you're resisting Americans, resisting Israelis more accurately, is that there's less of that. And you're sort of seen as just sort of one cog in the wheel. You're still a lone player, but you're seen as just, you're playing this much smaller role. You're not the lone hero to save the world. You're just trying to do your part in this occupation. And so, still, they say, because they have this core first-person shooter mechanic, the sort of American ideology they can't quite get away from. They're still trapped in that.
Right,
And so I think that brings up a good point about this distance between the narrative and the ludology of a game. Whereas then you can have a racist have a backstory and you can say, you know, he's a real human being, but procedurally they're still trying to kill you and you can't really do anything about that. So there's sort of this disconnect between humanizing them perhaps through narrative or visual cues, but they're still these dehumanized monsters just trying to kill you. From a procedural perspective.
But what's interesting is that you're only, sometimes in first-person shooters, you can't even try.
Yeah.
You can't even try and then fail. This is the interesting part of Lee Alexander's piece, is that in at least in Bioshock Infinite, you always have that gun just floating in your face. You're always pointing it at people. It's always there. And that really, that's your only mechanism of engaging with other people. Mm-hmm. And that's something that bothered me about this beautiful world constructed in Colombia, and in which you have nothing but visual engagement with. And you can't converse with anyone. You can't push anyone on what their ideals are, why they would support such a society, why this is a good place to raise your kids. There's none of that. There's no dialogue. It's monologue, and it's you're conversing essentially with digital bullets, and it's kind of, you know, that in and of itself is what I'm trying to say, I think, is the ultimate problematic. If there's never an option to take the non-combative approach, then what are we left to conclude? That violence can solve racism. And if it's not that, if it's that violence, racism is inherently violent, and any response to that is becoming the evil that you're fighting, which is the conclusion in certain respects of Bioshock Infinite, because you are both the hero and the villain in this world where two different multiple universes are kind of colliding, but...
And the Vox Populi are both the oppressors and the oppressed.
Yes, absolutely. They're just as ruthless. Yep.
A problem. problematic.
Yes, it's definitely problematic. But it really it points to this, I think, that this larger complication that we're at a point in games where we recognize the problem, but we've become, we think it's novel to point it out. And that was my problem with the first BioShock game, whereas he pointed out that you were blindly following these orders. And that's kind of a criticism of gamers themselves, who blindly follow orders and execute people without necessarily questioning them. My response to that is, if you don't offer a ludic opportunity or a systemic opportunity to not pursue that path, then you've created the system that you're critiquing, and you're charging $60 for it. Mm-hmm. Whereas, and we see that in the Far Cry 3, yeah. And we see that in Spec Ops The Line.
Yeah.
And they, both of them have said, what the moral, essentially what the morally right person would do would be to not play the game. Is that an acceptable solution to this moral conundrum that they're presenting you with?
No. I mean, it's not. If you want to be taken seriously as a medium and you want to say that you can say something, then turning it off is not, as the only option, is not viable. Especially since it is a commodity and people want to play it and things like that. But Steve, let me ask you this. Say that you approach one of the racists in BioShock Infinite, you talk it out with them, and you realize that he has all these reasons and he's very humanized, but you still have to, he's still going to try to kill you anyways afterwards. Do you think that's a step in the right direction? Is that not far enough? Because you still have, you know, again, procedurally it's the same thing. It's still evil, I guess, from a procedural perspective, if not a narratological perspective. But at the end of the day, if you still have to kill them, has anything been solved? Can narrative, I guess, trump gameplay mechanics in that sense?
I guess it's about what are you trying to do as a combatant in that world? Mm-hmm. Are you attacking the ideology, or are you there to derive some degree of entertainment from killing people whose ideology doesn't align with your own? Mm-hmm. Those are two very different projects, and games do not often offer the opportunity to take that social or political approach, and that's why Skyrim kind of works well. You can play a political game. You can engage with that on a level that is just not only is it not there, it seems like it's openly being excluded. And this is another thing that came up in the Ken Levine interview with his work at Looking Glass, is that he's really interested in film noirs and these characters that are not invested in the systems that they're nevertheless a part of. So he points to like Chinatown, where this detective has left the police force, but he's still, that's his trade, so he's kind of on the periphery. He doesn't really want to be part of that system, but he's still engaging with it. And that becomes really the basis for Thief, is that you're, if all these multiple factions, and you're there playing them off one another, and you're there for your own ends. The lone soldier and the film noir, the one that's kind of aloof from the problems, is exactly the opposite kind of values we want to forward in terms of how do we resolve these problems? And that's why that's the part of the larger criticism of these games that think that they're being clever by identifying that we're at a stalemate on how to grapple with things. Well, take a chance. Well, roll the dice on what would
be
a resolution.
In the wrong place. I mean, this is a genre that is called shooter. If there's going to, I mean, one of the common ways of describing gameplay is that it provides you with verbs and nouns. If the verb that you have going in is shoot, I mean, there are plenty of other genres that allow different approaches. Is it just that we've need a way to de-emphasize the shooter?
But the problem is
that
we
need to turn the shooter into something else.
You have these writers between Far Cry 3 and Spec Ops in interviews saying that they think that they are fundamentally deconstructing the problem. And they both, I believe them when they say that they feel like they're genuinely engaging with this almost perverse pleasure we have in killing in games. And they situate it within the context of their own lives. They have family members that have fought in Iraq. They know soldiers, and that they want to add the complexity, the moral human complexity, back into the game itself, which I think is a laudable attempt. So I think that if you can take the first-person shooter genre and make people feel a degree of moral responsibility, then that's a coup. That's you know, to use the militaristic metaphor, you've really taken something that is inherently violent and you've subverted that. That would be a great satire. I don't feel either of those games ever approach that. They revel in the violence because that's what their sales are based on. I don't think you can profit from your satire. I think that comes at the expense of the how genuine your satire really is.
Well, I mean, even Spec Ops, the line, there's basically one really bad scene, the White Phosphorus scene, where the player realizes that he or she's killed in a really horrible way the good guys and a bunch of civilians. And so there's, you go into the, and it actually, in the cutscene, it makes you walk through the aftermath and makes you sort of take it in. It's not like you've just killed this anthropomorphic luminescent image in the distance and it's fallen. You're seeing charred remains of mothers holding their babies. But that's, for that game, there's not a whole lot. I can't think of another point in the game other than that where it really tries to deconstruct the shooter genre. And it, I don't know, for me anyways, it was a poignant moment, but it also sort of felt flat because soon after you go back to just shooting guys again. And so it didn't really alter anything fundamentally for me. So again, I agree with you, Steve. I love that they made the attempt, and I do think that that's definitely a step in the right direction. But, does it absolutely deconstruct the genre? I don't think so. I don't think it goes nearly far enough, and I agree that we need to find games that can push that further and further. And also, just to go back to real life for a second, a lot of social psychology has shown again and again that people need stable in-groups and out-groups. So we like to feel like we're part of something, and unfortunately part of that is sort of joined together under a banner of exclusion. So we have to say we're part of this group and we're not part of that group. At sort of a very basic level, I think players need that sort of to feel like they're part of something bigger than themselves and that there's this other that they can exterminate. And so I think that's part of the appeal, and that's why it's so pervasive that you have these bad guys that you just have to kill, is that I think there is something exhilarating and exciting about virtual killing. And, Churchill said there's nothing more exhilarating than to be shot at without result. And I think that's what video games provide, is they provide that exhilaration where you have the sights and sounds of combat. But, of course, you never die. Everybody else dies, your buddies, the enemies. And so your sort of life is sort of affirmed, and as part of this in-group is affirmed through the binary structure of the shooter genre. So I think it's going to be very difficult to get away from it altogether. I think we're gonna need more savvy players that would appreciate a more nuanced approach to the genre.
Well, it's interesting that Walt Williams, the writer behind Spec Ops, he started a part of his career in the military, mm-hmm. and he said at one point he was watching it was one of those top down sort of air gunship perspectives, and they were shooting at. At a terrorist or an infidel, however you want to characterize the person, and the guy was running and trying to hide behind vehicles, and the people in the room were laughing, from what I understand in this interview, he just recoiled from that. He said that despite whether you think this is necessary or not, this action, you shouldn't derive some kind of joy from it. And you know, not to get all like Heideggerian on us, but there is that degree that screen has dehumanized the entity on the other side of it, and that's a big part of essentially the rhetoric of military technology, mm-hmm. is to create that distance so that you do not have to engage with those moral conundrums of killing other people. It's they're reduced to polygons, and that somehow makes it more acceptable. So in a certain respect, the odds are against us in creating a game with virtual entities that you feel real emotions for. But I think that's the height of our gameplay. That's the height of our experiences, is that when you feel something for a character, that's the mark of success. And that's what the movie AI is all about. Because they set up that can this family really care for this little boy? But by the end of the movie, assuming you care about that boy, they've already proved their point. That we can care about a fictitious, not only a fictitious character, but a fictitious robotic character.
Of course, they're stacking the deck a bit in that we know it's played by a human actor. And, you know.
That's true.
It'd be interesting to see a movie like that where they made a robot to play the
role. Short Circuit, Johnny Five. I felt terrible for him when Johnny Five finally bit the bullet. Yep. And to a lesser extent, Terminator. When he's going into that molten metal pit and he gives the thumbs up. It's a tear-jerking moment.
That's true. Wall-E?
Yeah.
Wall-E is a totally digitized character that we do feel some degree of compassion for.
Mm-hmm. I guess I would love to see a game where it sort of hit me in the gut every time I killed somebody, that I felt remorseful. And I don't know if you can do that in like a big budget shooter where you're killing thousands of people and you just...
That would be horrible to play.
It would, exactly. It would, but I mean...
Thousands of times.
Exactly, but maybe that's what we need to do. Like, killing is a horrifying thing.
Yeah, and I agree with that. They had a... I can't remember who it was, but I read an interview with someone that was like a consultant for... I think it was for like the Battlefield franchise. And he was an ex-military guy. And he had this really poignant saying, an expression in one of his interviews. He just said, I just like at one point, after you kill someone, you just walk up, and then this picture of the guy's family mm-hmm. falls out of his pocket. Yeah. It's like, that's all you have to do. If you don't feel any kind of compassion about that situation, if that doesn't make you at least consider your actions, then the problem isn't with the ludic system, it's with the player themselves. Yeah. But until you add that human element back into it, that's not even going to be, we're not even encountering that, the moral conundrum. And that's the problem that I have with this unmitigated evil, with zombies and with you know, Nazis, essentially, yeah. is that they are mechanisms, or they're straw men, essentially, so we don't have to encounter any kind of moral conundrum. But really, the problem with fighting a Nazi is that, you know, that those were people actually subscribed to that ideology. That's the horrifying part. The horrifying part is not war itself necessarily, it's that these are human beings that fundamentally subscribe to this belief, and that's the thing that you're oppressed by, and that's the thing you can't grapple with a gun. And that's something that if you leave that out, if you don't establish that in your narrative, then it leads us to believe that these really are just binary oppositions, and that they can be solved by one overcoming the other.
And to complicate that even a little bit further, I mean, it's hard to say, but a lot of German soldiers who survived the war said they didn't subscribe to that ideology, and they were basically forced into it. They were drafted. If they said anything wrong, of course, there's tremendous consequences for that. So, I mean, to me, that's even more pitiable, I think, is that these people, they're just sort of forced into this terrible situation, and they're not humanized. And I think, I mean, the Mel Gibson movie, We Were Soldiers, is about the Vietnam War, is a piece of propaganda big time. But there's this one scene where a Vietnamese soldier's about to attack Mel Gibson's character, and he puts his bayonet on. Before he charges Mel Gibson, he takes out a picture of his girlfriend, kisses it, and puts it back into his coat. And it's just this very small moment. It takes about 30 seconds. But I think it does exactly what you're talking about, Steve, is it just humanizes him for that split second, and you realize these aren't these caricatures, these aren't these inhuman monsters, these are people with lives and experiences. And so their lives should matter, and so we should respect it at some fundamental level.
Yeah, and that's something that the TV show Band of Brothers did really well. Yeah. There are points in which, you know, characters have to encounter the moral conundrum of, do I pull the trigger or not? And that's not in a game of Call of Duty. It's not and that's why the criticism turn off the game is a. I find absurdly dismissive of the actual problem itself. As you know, then create a system in which pulling the trigger isn't the only option, would be my response to that. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise you're profiting from the desire that you're critiquing.
Yeah.
I find it interesting that most of the examples we're pulling from in terms of things that inspire compassion are from either cinema or television. Yeah. Now, I know that the three of us aren't particularly of the side that... No, are particularly of the side that games offer something unique that film doesn't... has its own unique thing. So why are we continually going to film? Are there that few examples of compassion in game elements, in game mechanics?
I think in the big blockbusters, yeah, there really are. I mean, now where there's progress being made is in the sort of indie games. You think of Anthropy's Dysphoria. I think that's a great example of a game which breeds compassion for a perspective that not everybody has. And it does that through using the game mechanics, but also does it through text and narrative as well. But I think that it is exceedingly rare to find a big budget game. They're there, but a big budget game that really looks at the at humanizing the enemy in any meaningful way.
Is that really different? No, it is a little different, but I mean, most of our big mediums, your big budget things, aren't going to be the touching material. The problem with games is that we don't have very many big budget things that do that.
Yeah.
But I think this is a fitting counterexample is the Walking Dead games.
Yeah.
Because what they do is they use zombies to establish the sort of the drive that pulls everyone together. That's sort of your horror. That's your tragedy that pulls everyone together. But the real things that you're grappling with through the mechanics of the game is trying to manage the emotions and the feelings and the ambitions and ideologies of the people that you're forced to band together with. That's the conversation system isn't exactly elaborate, but what you're grappling with is that not everyone is in agreement. There is ambiguity about what we should do and how we should do it. And just by teaching people, or just by, not teaching sounds kind of condescending, but by forcing ourselves to go through scenarios where we're trying to strike the middle ground and it doesn't work because the game will eventually force you to pick a side, is a great way of reminding ourselves that despite what other games have been teaching us, there is ambiguity, and there, even in the dialogue options, it's still difficult to make everyone happy and to make the morally sound choice. You have, at certain points, you have to decide who lives and who dies.
Yeah.
Well, that gets back to my earlier point that The Walking Dead, if it models any existing established game genre, it's the old graphic adventure games. So if we're saying that the shooters should be doing this, is this trying to do something to a genre that the mechanics are set against it from the very beginning? Should we be doing instead just, well, let's put the shooter behind us? Let's, instead of the shooter, focus on making more games like Walking Dead that are big games?
I think that with the... I don't disagree with what Jeffrey Yohalem and Walt Williams are trying to do with their genres. I disagree with how they executed that. I think that if you look at a game like the first Deus Ex, which from the opening gives you the option and actually pretty ham-fistedly tells you these are people, taking the most lethal option isn't in your best interest. You need to consider that there are alternatives. And from the opening level, there are alternatives. And I think this is a great commentary. Non-lethal or non-combative approaches are infinitely more difficult in that game than going straight at the problem. And that's really what we're facing right now, is that the problems we're grappling with are far more difficult than our direct approaches seem to lead us to believe. And that's the thing. There's this whole area of the problem that our brains aren't even engaged with because we're on this linear approach to grappling with the task at hand.
Right, and I think part of the problem is just in the number of enemies you face in certain genres. Like, you can't humanize every single one of them. I mean, there's just finite resources again. Telltale's Walking Dead, not the other one that was made recently. Maybe we should distinguish. That game made people feel things. Like, you know, there's very well documented people. They cried over that game. I know I was speaking from personal experience. I generally felt bad when I had to decide who was going to die a horrible death over another. And you couldn't make everyone happy, and that frustrated me, but it frustrated me in a good way. It was an experience I was used to having in games, where I feel like I did everything right to the best of my ability, but it still wasn't good enough. And no matter what you do, people are going to be upset with you. You're going to lose certain gameplay options. And so it penalizes you, and I thought that was really refreshing. But to your point, Michael, can you do that in a big budget shooter where you're killing 2,000?
Or should you be looking to
do
that?
Well, I mean, the thing is about a shooter, though, is they're uniquely situated to critique war, I think.
That's a good point.
So I think they have to do something for, I mean, it's hard to critique war in, you know, like a game like Walking Dead, perhaps. So I think there has to be a way to humanize the enemy in some way while still keeping the big budget mechanics that people love and that game companies are going to keep doing because it makes the money.
Right. Well, and you look at Tomb Raider.
Yeah.
Rihanna Project came out and said that they as a team tried to keep the player from having the gun in their hands for the longest time.
Yeah.
They wanted to start the body count further into the game.
Yeah.
What drove me to pitch this idea was Call of Duty Black Ops. When they open up, you're in Cuba, there is very little context, and you, at the end of that level, within 15 minutes, you're operating an M50 machine gun into a crowd of soldiers whose base you broke into and attempted to assassinate their leader of their country, and yet somehow you are this, you're supposed to be the agent of good there. And I think the game goes on to critique how the government and the military uses their soldiers to their own end, but I think that a game that still derives pleasure from that combat is putting the player in an awkward position by not offering an alternative.
Mm-hmm. Here's the thing I wanted to bring up. We were one of the inception points, I guess, for this conversation was what a good 21st century villain would look like.
Mm-hmm.
Steve, I know you've read William Slocum's Majestic Reflexivity, where he basically goes with the idea that games force players to adopt the ideology that the game has by getting you to play it.
Mm-hmm.
That whenever you play a game, you're interpolated into becoming a playing subject. So is a 21st century villain sort of the system itself, the empire with a big E, with Negri and Holt's kind of, or Hart's approach to it? Because I also have looked at a list of what people think of as the biggest game villains, and one of the ones that usually tops the list is GLaDOS from Portal, who's situated as sort of the game itself, and as this voice that follows you around everywhere.
And I think that that's part of a growing list of games that are offering this meta-commentary, because there's a larger indecision about where to go from here. Where how do we proceed? What is a villainy that isn't a single face? And that's why I brought up sort of Nazism. And Hitler is the poster child for Nazism. That's a mechanism for reducing the horrors of the Holocaust into the ideology of a single person. Whereas what you really need to grapple with is how an entire country was largely persuaded of that ideology. So
and that's where the single player, single hero thing really gets skewed, because a single person doesn't change an entire country. They do it with everyone in.
Exactly, and we have a difficult time grappling with that notion. And even in our MMOs, they are largely, the quest givers are giving them to single people. They're about solving problems, sometimes as groups, but there's still, there's no emergence in there. There's no larger set of mechanics evolving out of that, because
what
they need to support the lone soldier and the
EVE Online.
Eve is a really interesting
example. It's an interesting example because it's emergent situations, but it also comes down to a lot of shooting and combat. I think maybe a more interesting example that's not very well known, and I don't really know enough to talk about it intelligently, A Tale from the Desert, where the idea is that you've got an era that keeps repeating itself and players have to decide among themselves what rules apply to the community. It gets to the point where there's very little what we traditionally think of as a game in it. And I'm not doing a very good job describing it because I don't know it very well. There are a lot of alternatives.
Well, I think the zombie is an interesting figure. If the zombie is positioned, as it is in Walking Dead, as a given in the scenario, and not something that you're being driven to resolve. So some zombie material, some zombie fiction is about finding out what the cause of the plague was and then solving it. Mm-hmm. Others are more of the post-apocalyptic, we have accepted this situation and now we need to band together to resolve it. And there's an ecological criticism embedded in that, and that we are facing a problem in the ecological crisis that is globe spanning. And yet we're developing skills and we're engaging with systems that are about individuals solving problems, individuals profiting from solving those problems, and essentially creating something that other people will use rather than collaboratively looking for a resolution. So
it'd
I think...
interesting to see. I mean, Daisy's got the emergent thing, but people just wind up killing each other mostly upon sight. It would be interesting to do a Daisy version where you knew from the start, this is where the game's going to start. Everyone's here. You don't get to respawn afterwards. Cooperate, or it's all over fast.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the online multiplayer games, the only way you can get rid of the sort of solipsism that we're used to in games where the lone hero. But at the same time, I mean, it's hard to get away from that because we are individuals. We can't access anyone else's being, so to speak. And moreover, the idea of the lone hero is, as you know, as old as we can think. I mean, Epic of Gilgamesh, the Assyrian tale in like 2200 BC or whatever, one of our first pieces of literature, is about a lone guy going out into the woods and becoming a hero, making a name for himself and trying to get immortality. And so, I mean, it's ancient. And so I think it's really tough, again, to sort of get away from this model. It's old, we're used to it. It fits in with our own sort of psychological needs.
I thought that, and this is one of those names that I am not going to pronounce correctly, Jonas Karatsi's The Sea Will Claim Everything, mm-hmm. The game's ending had a very interesting approach to this, where basically it turns out that all of the quests you have done throughout that point in the game haven't been to no more than to just inspire the general populace to do their own uprising, and the game explicitly tells you, okay, there's still a struggle ahead, but we have to do this ourselves, and you have to have faith in us that mm-hmm. we can do it once you've left.
Well, yeah, I mean, what would a sort of non-solipsistic game look like? I mean, maybe if there is a goal, the player only plays, you know, a very small part, and you just sort of, you know, kick the ball down a yard or so of the field. And you have to rely on others to sort of do the rest. Because that's, you know, actually how it works. Nobody saves the world on their own, of course. So again, I think it'll be really tough to do unless you have really smart AI.
I think the example you brought up earlier, Dead Rising, is mm-hmm. an example of how
yeah,
it happened. A game world
true.
Where events are programmed to
yes.
take place,
mm-hmm.
whether you're there or not,
mm-hmm.
and your presence can change things. But you have to go significantly beyond the way Dead Rising does it. But
yeah.
the simulation goes on regardless of whether you're there to do anything about it.
That's a good point.
Yeah, that's really tied to the time is not specific to the player, which
yeah.
is rather absurd, is that it's tied directly to your individual actions. And that
the mass effect.
Yeah, you need things that perpetuate without your participation. And then also you need to show that there are consequences for inactivity. And that's really what the ecological issue is about, is that, well, you know, let's wait and see when it hits the tipping point. Well, if it hits the tipping point, it's already too late. But we don't know how to, I don't think, at least in the Western world, we don't know how to deal with a problem like that. We're not really proactive people. We're far more comfortable with being reactive. And is it a coincidence that in a lot of our media, we are either passive recipients of a narrative that's being conveyed to us, or we're players within a system that flows directly from our actions and we derive pleasure from that sort of that position within the system of being the one that perpetuates it. I think it's worth returning to some of the remarks that Jeffrey Yohalem made in this Rock, Paper, Shotgun interview. And I'll just read them out here. He says that, I think we haven't really explored our language. The industry keeps wanting more shooting games. It keeps wanting more games that involve sneaking up behind someone and stabbing them. So then I think we both said, that's Walt Williams and Jeffrey Yohalem, let's make a game that explores what that actually means and how it feels. But then, once you've done that, you can't really do it again. If we did our jobs, then every other game that's about that mechanic would feel the same. At that point, people would say, we want another experience.
I think that's one of the responses that you've seen, especially for BioShock Infinite, that people, that a lot of people are saying we want a different experience.
And how do we, how are we going to make that happen when a game like BioShock Infinite is at 95% on Metacritic and its sales are very comfortably positioned on the top of the charts? That's his point, is that, that, and that's, I think that's why they feel comfortable making the critique that they're making, because that's where the money is to make those games. And there's that side that if you shouldn't force your agenda on someone else, and I think that someone could come back at this podcast and say, this is incredibly condescending and entirely biased towards your perspective of what we should use games as.
Condescending is what we do.
Yes. But in a certain respect, they are giving people what they want. And who are we to say that we should be manipulating with that? But I feel that, as we said off the beginning, if every simulation is an interpretation, then you're already participating in an interpretation of the social and political dynamic, whether you want to admit that or not. So we need to take a more active role in that.
Well, again, I got to come back to, I think that it has to be done in the indie space, at least for now, because, I mean, these are big publicly traded companies with shareholders, and that's the sort of long and short of it. They do, it's like a big movie studio. You don't want to take the big risk. You want to go for the sequel, which is going to, if you want Avengers 5, it's going to make, you know, another $1 billion. And so it's very tough to, I think, to persuade a big budget studio to take these risks and not give players what they want, because then you get, you know, really low Metacritic scores, and then all of a sudden, you know, your game doesn't sell as well, and so that's a problem.
I think we need to, I think that's true, but I think we also need to hold people accountable for what they say their games are about. You look at the creator, like the developer that pitched Infamous. That language is just absurd. Like, it's not offensive, but it's just downright absurd that you would articulate those thoughts. That's offensive. Well, it is offensive to the people that are actually struggling with poverty, and you come back at them with, "What if you had superpowers?"
Yeah.
And that's fine. We the game should be entertaining, but to position it in that context is offensive.
I mean, at the same time, I see what they're doing. I mean, they have these sort of, you know, like blue sky ideas. Ideally, we'd love to do this, and then the sort of hard, I guess, economic realities hit them. And, you know, they're only given this much leeway. And so, I mean, I can't think of a big budget game that was really risky and really successful. And that actually took real risks. I mean, it seems like it's just, it's a money-making machine. And so we just keep giving people what they want. I mean, the Call of Duty games, I mean, Call of Duty 4 came out, I think, 2007. Okay, so that's, you know, 6 years, almost 6 years ago now. And there's been a new installment every year, and the game has not changed. Like, I mean, almost very, very subtly you get more perks, but it's the same thing, and people keep buying it.
Dishonored's probably the most recent big-budget game that wasn't actually another iteration of a series.
Well, I think part of it, too, and then I've tried to articulate this on FPS with the diegesis and... and this, which was also kind of following from that ludonarrative dissonance, is that what Far Cry 3 and Spec Ops do is they take risks on the narrative level. They are not taking mechanics, they're not taking risk on the level of mechanics, and that leads to that disconnect. And what we really need is we need the system and the narrators to be telling the same story if it's to be effective. If you think that there's a broken aspect of the mechanics, but you're going to use those same mechanics to tell us that they're broken through the narrative, that's not effective. That's not an effective criticism. That's actually exploiting the problem at hand, and not, I don't think that you can do that once, and I think BioShock the first did that quite well, but that was, what, 6 years ago? 7 years ago? We need to move on. We need people that are willing to take a risk, and I don't think it's fair to say that all of these games need to take this risk, but I fundamentally disagree with developers and writers who think that they're being risky when I really don't think that they are.
If I can offer another example, what I think is a good melding of the narrative and to form a larger message, Abaddon, the Black Fortress, it's by a developer whose name is escaping me at the moment, Spider Web is the name of the company. But the idea of the game is that it draws on something that Jason mentioned earlier, that you have to create an other, that there's a bunch of five nations that got together. We're going to form a pact that from now on, everyone in our pact, we play nice, and we direct all of our aggression towards all of the countries on the outside. And they come up with this group, or this fortress, Abaddon, that monitors everything that goes on the continent at that point to make sure that all of the aggression is being directed towards these outside groups. And you play in the game one of Abaddon's special agent forces. And the climax of the game is that you slowly learn, not very surprisingly, that the leader of Abaddon, Redbeard, does some very questionable things in the pursuit of this goal of lasting peace. So you have a choice at the end of the game whether to side with him or go against him. Now, if you side with him, there basically is no final fight. The game just ends there, and that's it. If you decide to go against him, then, first of all, you had to have made alliances with everyone in your party, or they won't fight with you at this point. And it's the first point in the game where you do control the entire party, so it's causes you to think differently about how your players or how your characters respond to each other. Second, it is a much difficult fight than nearly anything in the game. So it's ludically implies this message. It's not simply about seeing the evil and going, I'm going to stand up against this. It's being able to, as a player, I might decide, okay, I'm going to be complicit with this guy just because I don't think I can beat this, and I want to see the ending.
Yeah, you see, for me, I mean, I'm not familiar with the game, but, I mean, procedurally, that to me speaks to the plight of people in 1930s Germany, young men who, do you go along with it, and it's easy, or do you try to stand up to it, and you're probably going to get killed for doing so? And so that seems to me to mimic that process a lot more than games about World War II. Is that, it's
a
difficult
little less...
to stand up.
Redbeard's no Hitler.
It's easy to go along with things, right?
Yeah,
and it's difficult,
it's,
and it might
it
result.
It really did a good job of presenting easier to go with the flow in this case.
That's a good point. The recognition of evil is not in itself an admirable feat. Mm-hmm. It's how do you address that without succumbing to the mechanisms that make that an evil entity. And until now, it's been
and again,
violence.
The acknowledgement
is met with
that
violence.
Sometimes what you're facing isn't evil at all.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So we just had this long conversation on whether games can impart skills on us for solving essentially what we're calling sort of 21st century problems, which are, I guess, we didn't never really identify them. Which I would say would be social problems, the disconnect between 99% and the 1%, that the class distinction that is increasingly dividing but isn't really being addressed on any kind of front in any kind of... we're still in a position where we're identifying the problem, that there's this massive divide, and we're not developing any kind of resolution to that.
And on that subject, The Sea Will Claim Everything should probably get a shout-out for being a game that speaks almost more or less directly to Greece and austerity issues.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great point too.
But again, it's the indie versus AAA issue.
Yeah, and I think that there are political issues, especially, I guess, for coming from a Canadian perspective, in our country, the right is united and the left is fractured, and the left is kind of struggling with how to deal with the having at least two political parties that represent the left that then splits the vote. And so we have a majority of liberal-minded Canadians that aren't represented by the minority government because of this divide on the left. I think that's another... Now, that's not really a ludic problem, but I think it's a political thing that is about how do we as individuals affect a larger change, especially in this country when the majority of people are...
How do we resolve conflicts?
Yeah, essentially, how do we resolve conflicts? And the conflicts should match the context in which we exist, which we live in. And that's sort of the larger critique, is that there's a disconnect between the problems presented in games and the problems we encounter in our daily lives.
Yeah, and it speaks to the broader issue of, as academics and game critics, do we have some sort of responsibility to exert pressure on the game industry? As it stands, I can say I don't think we feel very relevant at this point on any sort of big budget game decisions. But can we be a relevant voice? Can we actually enact the sort of change that we're hoping for, and not just critique the problems, but actually present solutions to them. And from my view, I think we do have some sort of responsibility as critics. It's not enough to just tear down, but we have to offer solutions as well. And so I do think that we have to try to exert influence onto the industry whenever possible.
And I think it's some people would say, okay, does the literary scholar also have to be an author? Is it often the refrain that comes back at, do you need to really participate in the systems you're making comments on? I think that the Far Cry 3 makes an excellent example of, yes, we do, because there's that point in which you are forced to torture your own brother. In order to perpetuate the game, you have to torture him. And I think by asking you to participate in the system, that affords us a degree of responsibility for our actions, that then, as critics, we need to come back and then say, we need to move away from this sort of constrained violence as a means of resolution. I think that, I guess the larger thing is that because we're participants rather than necessarily slightly more passive viewers or recipients, that it's our right to push for more complexity and I think that that's a lot with what transgender study is dealing with. I think that's what a lot of feminism is dealing with, is the absurd lack of representation hits a critical point. And if we as academics sit back and just continue to critique games that do not represent our situations or our struggles, then we're no better than those that are putting out these satirical games that actually, in a lot of ways, are wasting an opportunity to actually put forward something that's going to resolve the problem rather than just point at it and then profit from it.
I think one thing that we have to do that viewers may be, or listeners may be anticipating me saying at this point, given the number of games I've plugged over the last few minutes, I think we need to promote elements of games that we find are positive and are doing the right things and are out there but just don't have the attention that the AAA get, in part because you have these developers who are, and these huge marketing machines that are promoting aspects of games that ultimately wind up not being there.
Yeah, and I've been guilty of that today, of kind of lumping everyone together because I'm really riled up about it. But as soon as you take the people that are doing it right and put them in the same group as the people that are doing it wrong, then you just sacrifice what you're trying to promote. So.
So good game developers, keep it up. You're out there.